every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long, true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Francisco Martinez.
And I'm Kendall Stormo. Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our theme for this show is Stranger Than Fiction.
We'll hear stories of the unpredictable, the unreliable, and the unbelievable.
First, we're going to hear a story from Jay Stange.
Jay doesn't just admit to living in Spernard with his chicken coop in a compost pile. He proudly proclaims it. Here's Jay Stange.
So, it's the summer of 1999, and I am a tired man. I need a break because I've just spent 3 years working 60, 70-hour weeks with this media startup business. And, you know, we're like all about the social justice and all about public media campaigns, and our business folded. And at the same time, a relationship that I was in just kind of unraveled. I'm living in a $400 a month apartment in Spenard. Not too many prospects going on at the moment, but the good news is that I have very few responsibilities and no commitments. So when my friend Leah from the Skate Betties, that's an all-girl punk band from back in the day, left town to go to graduate school, I bought her candy red Fender Squire bass for $100. And I sort of learned how to play it. And I was at this open mic, and this guy was like, "Hey, I'm looking for a bass player." And I'm like, "Hey, I know how to play the bass." And the next thing you know, I am in a hippie jam band touring Alaska. So we're in Homer at Alice's Champagne Palace, and our buddy Charlie calls and he says, "Hey, we got a gig. It's in Manly. It's July 4th weekend in Manly Hot Springs. You know, you gotta go." And we're like, "Sure," you know, so we jump in the cars and we drive 600 miles from downtown Homer to Fairbanks. And none of us had ever been to Manly before, so we had no idea that Manly was another 160 miles past Fairbanks. Much of it on very dirt road. It's 90 degrees and very dusty. And we get there and we're late. And the guy that runs the place, his name is Bob. And he's a retired state trooper. And he has a stern look on his face. And he's like, "Well, I'm glad you guys made it, because we have been needing a good country band in town." And I'm setting up the stage, and I look up, and there's a bunch of elders sitting at the bar with Western wear and cowboy boots. And they're drinking coffee and maybe sipping a couple light beers, you know, like that. So, 2-3 songs into our first set, they are underwhelmed. And I see a couple of backs start to turn towards the stage area, and I'm thinking that we're in trouble here at the end of the road where the rivers begin. And then this guy, he kind of, I don't know where he came from, but he's dancing, and he's got this big white crazy beard and a red handkerchief, and he's got those Oshkosh overalls. You know the ones, those train conductor overalls with the blue and gray stripes? And he's drinking something weird, like sake on the rocks, and I don't know. And, you know, he's just like giving it, you know? And I just couldn't take my eyes off him, and I was like, "Oh, that guy is gonna save us," you know? And so we made it through the first set, and then like while we're taking a break, the door comes pounding open, and in come like 15 big like wildland firefighters, most of them girls from Nanana, and they're kind of sunburned and ready to party, you know. And so the rest of the night goes great. We had a great time. And so the next day, it's July 4th, and there's like the sack races, and kids are jumping off the bridge into the river, and it's really hot. And we kind of are practicing some country songs. You know, we want to try and, you know, do well for the elders in town. So, you know, we had a good day, and we come out the second night, and we open with Good Hearted Woman. and people are dancing and everything's great. And we're like, wow, what an adventure here in Manly. It's a wonderful night. And about three songs into our set, this guy, he comes running up to me and he says, shut the PA off. And I'm like, what? I thought we were doing pretty good. And he says, no, you don't understand. Shut it off. So I shut the PA off and I look up and over by the bar, there's this scrum of people, and the first thing I hear is people arguing about who knows CPR the best. And one of the firefighters from the Nana jumps in there and starts working on this person, and then things get kind of weird. Next thing I hear is a loud whine out the back door, and it's the town medic running in on her four-wheeler, and she comes running through the bar and parts the crowd, and she says, where is he? And she starts working on him, you know, one, two, three, four, five, breathe, one. You know, it seems like it takes forever. And finally, somebody hugs her and tells her to stop. And you know, there is our buddy Buzz, you know, this guy with the beard and the dancing, and he's dead. And so we kind of go out in the backyard, and we're sitting on some benches back there. Bob puts a sheet on him and calls the state trooper from Live and Good. It's like an hour away to come and declare him dead. And we're all sitting out in the back. People are stunned. The band's looking at each other like, wow, did that just happen? And all of a sudden, I see people coming from everywhere, like out of the trees, and four-wheelers are pulling up, and there's cars parking, trucks parking on the dirt road, and people go in the bar. I followed them in there. And somebody's taking Buzz's boots off, and they put them on the bar, and everybody's stuffing the boots full of cash and drinking and telling stories. And somebody hands me a duck fart. I drink it, and another one. And I'm talking and getting carried away. I look down, and I realize at one point that I'm standing on the edge of the shroud that's covering Buzz, and his beard is sticking out one corner. Finally, the state trooper comes and, they load Buzz into the back of a truck with the jumper cables and the motor oil bottles, and I don't know where they take him. He's gone, you know. And the same guy that told me to shut the pee off, he comes over and he's like staring at me, you know, and he says, ain't y'all gonna play anymore? So after the night, I'm talking to Bob and this elder that held up the cocktail napkins that had Amazing Grace. We sang Amazing Grace, and she says that Buzz, you know, was a local. He'd been there all his life, and about a year ago, the doctor told him his heart was bad. And he moved into Fairbanks, tried to live the straight life for a while. And he knew that 4th of July and New Year's Eve were the big parties in Manly, and so she said that he'd come out there for one last party. And all I know is that I'm sure that we weren't the first people that man saved with his, you know, sparkling smile and his raspy laugh and his dancing. And so I took a little piece of him back with me down that dusty road to Spinard.
That was Jay Stange, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour, where we hear true stories told by Alaskans.
The next storyteller spends his summers as a wildland firefighter. Here's Lucas Schlemmy.
This story takes place 6 years ago. I was 16 at the time, so now you guys all know my age. It was right after my mom and dad told my younger sister and I that they're getting divorced. And my father, in all of his infinite wisdom, decides that the best way I'm going to deal with all of this is we're going to go on an adventure. Because that's how we dealt with things back then. Any new life things, any emotions, we just go on an adventure. We go do fun stuff together, we get back, and everything would be great. Because that's how that works. And, I'm 16 at the time, super surly, not fun to be around. So I just had no interest in doing whatever he wanted to do. But, you know, I don't have a whole lot to say in the matter. So he kind of cooks up this idea, and we're going to kayak down a Kluna Lake. It's 7 miles. We're going to hike back to the glacier. It's another 6 miles. And then we're going to come back, and we're all going to do it in a day. So it's a 14-mile kayak and a 12-mile hike. So it's a pretty good day. And so we're going, and, you know, like I said, I have no desire to be on this trip, but here I am. and we're kayaking, and it's a nice day. It goes without a hitch. It's like a straight shot. Can't miss it. Hike back to the glacier. It's, you know, it's a glacier. It's pretty cool. Hike back, and so at this point where, you know, I'm pretty tired, and I'm just, all I'm thinking about is the final leg of this journey, this 7-mile kayak home, and then I'm done. So I take my pack, and I go, and I shove it into my kayak hatch, and I hear this pop and a hiss, and I see some red, and I have just enough time to think, that's kind of weird. And then, like, boom, it's like I'm punched in the face. And, you know, I'm on my back, and I'm kind of screaming, and it's like the worst burning sensation I've ever felt. And it's, you know, I can't see, and I can't breathe, and I can't talk. And my dad kind of, he has no idea what's going on, so he looks over and he goes, what happened? And I just choke out, bear spray. Because what had happened is careless me had just shoved my pack in the hatch, and the bear spray top that I keep with me, because I'm a responsible hiker, caught and just right in the face got me. So he kind of, like, being the quick thinker he is, just grabs me by the back and drags me over to the lake, and he's, you know, we're, like, kind of washing my face out and, you know, trying to clean all this stuff off. And as this is going on, I have this thought that, you know, when you, like, eat spicy food, you're not supposed to drink water because it's not going to help. You need milk, and you need bread. And we didn't have any milk with us, but what we did have was some tortillas that we were going to use for lunch. So in, like, a fit of desperation, I run over the kayaks, and I just grab the tortillas, and I just start scrubbing my face with them like it's a loofah, and I'm just going nuts. And, like, you know, he's pretty worried at this point because that's not a normal thing to do under most circumstances. So I'm, like, scrubbing my face, and he's kind of, like, bucket brigading with water, and we kind of get it under control to where I can, like, see and talk and breathe again. But, you know, it still burns. It's not going to go away. It's, like, it's on there. And, but, you know, we kind of examine our options. Like, well, you've used the last of the food. We kind of got to go home. So he, like, puts me back in the kayak and, you know, super supportive through the whole thing, make sure I'm not going to tip over. And we start kayaking home. It's just a quick 7 miles back. So at this point, I'm, like, pretty beat down, and I'm just kind of paddle after paddle, and I don't have a great sense of what's going on. I think, you know, like, it's probably about a half hour. Like, I'm just super thirsty after this whole ordeal. So I reach back, and I grab my water bottle, and I take a big swig of water, and a now very familiar burning sensation runs down my throat, because if you guys don't know how bear spray works, it goes off in a cloud, so everything in that cloud is going to be coated, including the water bottle that was right there. So I've now bear sprayed myself for the second time of the trip, and with as much grace as I can at the moment, I quickly paddle over shore, and luckily there's a stream running down, and I just run, and I dunk my head in the stream, and, you know, my dad, he still doesn't know what's going on, but he assumes it's bear spray related at this point. So he kind of paddles over, he's sitting next to me, he's, like, you know, trying to joke and, you know, make things better, and every now and again, he'll pull my head out of the water, make sure I don't drown myself, and I'll go back down. And no, you know, no concept of how long, like, you know, time is out the window, like, whatever. I'm just in a lot of pain. And he, you know, we're like about to start going again, and he says, you know, it's not that bad. I can see the shore from here, which is not comforting if you guys have been to Cluna Lake, because you can see the shore the whole way. So, like, thanks, Dad. Yeah, let's go. So, you know, same thing. Like, I'm just head down, and, like, I honest do not know how long it took to get back, because I'm just, like, paddle after paddle trying not to flip over. And we get to the end, and we're, like, 200 feet offshore, and I look up, and I see a bear on shore. And then I see another bear on shore, and then I'm seeing hundreds of bears on shore. And I go, Dad, that's how we can't go to shore. And he's like, oh, God, well, okay, why can't we go to the shore? I said, because there's hundreds of bears everywhere. And this starts, like, a 20-minute back and forth about how I'm pretty sure there's bears. And he's like, and he finally, you know, he talks me down, and he says, Lucas, between the two of us, who do you think probably has better eyesight right now? And I have to concede, like, it's probably you. And he's like, okay, who do you think's in, like, a slightly better mental state right now? And again, I'm like, yeah, it's probably you. So, and he's like, you know, you're just gonna have to trust me on this one, that I'm not leading you into a pack of bears. I'm like, that would be, you know, matching up with your past behaviors, so I'll trust you on this one. So, you know, he leads me ashore, and as you guys can tell, there were no bears. And we load up, and we're driving home. It was a pretty quiet car ride back. And I just know that most of the car ride back, he's, like, thinking about how he's going to explain to his new ex-wife about how he definitely broke her son. And like all I'm thinking is like I would just kill for like a big glass of milk right now. Thank you.
That was Lucas Schlemmy. You'll be happy to hear at this time there are no long-lasting physical effects from the incident featured in Lucas's story. The jury is still out on long-term mental effects. This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Our theme is Stranger Than Fiction. We will be hearing stories of the unpredictable, the unreliable, and the unbelievable.
Our next storyteller works as a biologist here in Anchorage. She was born in Hong Kong and grew up all around the world. Here's Layla Arson.
Okay, so the year is 1996, and I am a first-year college student at Prescott College in Arizona. And I'm studying environmental science, and I keep seeing all these really fun-looking classes in the adventure education department, and I want to learn those skills so that I can do science in remote places. So somehow I talk my way into this, taking this upper-level field class, and there are three requirements. The first one is you have to have already taken your wilderness first responder class, which I'd done. And then the second two were you had to be willing to eat anything, and you had to promise not to complain. And I should have known right then what the class was going to be like, or at least who was teaching the class. There were two instructors, Robin and Mike. And Robin was this avid sea kayaker who spent half the year guiding kayak trips in Baja and then the other half leading Prescott College students around the desert. And then Mike was this really fiery Welshman, and he had a really strong accent. And he was probably in his mid-60s when I took the class from him, and he could out-hike or out-paddle any of us 20-somethings, and he never let us forget it. He was kind of on one hand this tough guy personality, and then on the other hand, a charming and really hilarious guy. So we're on a three-week kayaking stint of this semester-long trip, and we're in Baja, and we're about 10 days in, and we decided to take a layover day so we could practice our water rescue skills. So everything's out of our boats, and we're all kind of strewn down the beach, and as we're going to bed that night, you know, we never slept in tents because it's beautiful weather and it's dry and there are no bugs. It's like the opposite of Alaska. So you just lay your sleeping bag out on the beach and it's beautiful. Except for Mike, he always set up a structure no matter what the weather was like or where we were. He would set up a tent or a tarp or a megamid. And so this night he sets up a megamid, which is like a pyramid-shaped floorless tent. And he would be, you know, just far enough away that he could kind of have his own space, but close enough that we could still hear him when he was heckling us. So it's a beautiful moonless night, and it's dark as can be, and the desert stars are just incredible. I drift off to sleep, and the next thing I remember is just this blood-curdling screaming. I mean, it sounds like a woman screaming for her life, and I bolt upright, and I'm trying to piece together what's happening, and I'm like, who is screaming? And what could possibly make someone scream like that on a beach in Baja? And is this real? Because we just did this whole like water-based scenario skills training, and now are they throwing some land-based training for us in the middle of the night? I can't figure out what's real. And I can tell that my classmates are feeling similarly because they're kind of sitting halfway up in their sleeping bags and straining to hear. And then a voice comes and it says, "Somebody help me! Somebody freaking help me!" And I knew then that it was real. And Shannon, who's sleeping next to me, says, "It's Mike." And so we start grabbing headlamps and shoes, and we're running over to his mid, and he really was not that far from us. And as I get there, headlamps are starting to kind of assemble on him, and he is halfway out of the mid, and he's still in a sleeping bag, and he is covered in blood. Head, body, all over his bag. And I'm trying to figure out in my brain, like, what happened to you? And Robin says, "We need the first aid kit. First aid kit's in the mid." So she goes into the mid to get it, and as she's going in, Mike says, "It's still in there." And the words are barely out of his mouth before she's flying back out of the mid, and there is a bobcat attached to her back. and it's chewing on her neck. And so we're all take a big step back. And Shannon, who's the one who said, it's Mike, he always wore these huge combat boots. Like, no matter what we were doing or what the weather was like we'd be in sea kayaks and he'd have his combat boots on, or on the beach and he had a combat boots on, or 2 o'clock in the morning and he's got his combat boots on. So he kicks the cat off of Robin's back. And then it is in the air. And he kind of kicked it at an angle, so it's like spinning in the air. And it's hissing. And it's got foam coming out of his mouth. And its eyes are glinting in our headlamps. And we're just trying to get away from the cat at this point. And it lands on the ground, and then it starts jumping around at us, and we're jumping backwards, trying to keep away from it, and just put whatever we can between us and the cat. And I grabbed a kayak paddle, and Shannon grabs a fishing spear, and we're just trying to get anything between us and it. And finally, it takes off into the bushes, and some of us just, our headlamps are trained on this cat, and some of us keep watching the cat. And others of us start tending to Robin and Mike because we now have 2 wounded people. And we know from the behavior of the cat and the foaming of the mouth that the cat was probably rabid. And so we also know from our training that we've got about 24 hours to get Robin and Mike to definitive care before treatment becomes less effective. And we are about a 4-day paddle from the closest takeout point. So we also know that we need a good, better way than paddling to get them out. So there's little fishing villages all along the way, and we've seen fishing boats out, pongas, little open skiffs, and we've bought fish from some of these fishermen. So our plan A is to get a ponga and get Robin and Mike in a ponga and get them out to a village that's on the road system. And so they can somehow get a vehicle and get them out to the highway so they can get a bus and they can get back to La Paz where they can find a hospital. So at daybreak, we're packing up our kayaks and we also send 2 people up and over the rise to the next beach because there's a Knowles group there, a National Outdoor Leadership Group, that's camped and we know they're gonna be there for a few days and we wanted to tell them, hey, maybe not the best place to camp. There's a crazy cat here. And as it turns out, they were also attacked that night. And who was attacked? Their Welsh instructor. So they say, we've got a boat coming in at 9 a.m. to resupply us, so let's put Robin and Mike and our Welsh guy on this boat and get them out to a village. So at that point, we have to say goodbye to Robin and Mike, and we don't know when we're gonna see them again. We are left then 7 students on our own to kayak out 4 days. Not knowing if Robin and Mike are going to be there to pick us up, or if they're going to be okay, or if they'll even be able to rejoin our group. So at that point, we say goodbye to Robin and Mike, and we start our paddle. And shortly into our paddle, we run into Manuel, who is a fisherman who we had bought fish from a few days earlier. And you know, we paddle up to him, and he says, ¿Qué pasó? And we said, well, there was a problem. There was a gato, a cat, and as soon as he heard the word gato, he stopped, and he said, I have to go get them right now. That cat killed someone last week, and I need to go get Robin and Mike. And we said, well, there's this boat coming in at 9, and he said, no, that boat's on Mexico time, and I need to go get them. And luckily, Manuel saved the day. By the time he got them to a village at 1 p.m., the boat that was supposed to be there resupplying at 9 hadn't left yet. But they were able to get to a town, they were able to get a vehicle, get a bus, and get back to La Paz, and they were there to pick us up 4 days later, and they were bandaged and sore, but okay. And now I know when the prerequisites for something are be willing to eat anything, or you know, promise not to complain, then I know that it's probably gonna be an adventure, but I might get a story out of it.
That was Layla Arson, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Just a quick reminder that all past Arctic Entry stories are available for listening on our website, arcticentries.com, as well as through iTunes and SoundCloud.
Now we'll listen to a story from Charlene Juliason. Charlene has lived in Anchorage since graduating from UAA and works as manager at an Alaskan Native Regional Corporation.
Okay, so this was back in 1993. when I was still going to college, and I lived with my mom. I went to college up here in Anchorage, but I lived with my mom down in Kenai, and she had a rather large house and also a large backyard. And in her backyard, she had a Bayliner boat that was pretty large. And the trailer that it was on was chalked with pieces of wood, because Alaskans, do we chalk it with those things that you can buy at the store? Heck no. We chalk it with wood, right? And the trailer was tilted up, and on the tongue of the trailer, we had a couple of hoses that were connected together, and so for watering the lawn and plants and stuff, on the tongue of the trailer, there were a couple of hoses. So in the middle of the night, I got up because I heard what was sounded like horses running in the backyard. It was like 1 a.m. And so I got up and I looked out the window and I couldn't see anything. So I went and looked out the front door, and in the back, I can see a moose towing the Bayliner in the backyard. Pretty soon, my mom, who had a room downstairs, she comes up and she's like, "What's going on?" I said, "There's a moose towing your Bayliner in the backyard." So we're looking off the porch and we can see it, and we're watching it for a couple of minutes, and pretty soon it comes around and it goes to the side of where she has her Ford Explorer, which is only 1 year old, and it sideswipes it. And it gets stuck. So now we're standing and we see it, and it's stuck there. So now this moose is standing out in front of the driveway with this hose wrapped around its neck, and it's bucking and it's pulling, and there's nothing that we can do. And so it's got a little bit of hose there between the tongue of the trailer and itself, and I'm thinking, what can we do? So I'm like, I'm gonna go get a knife. I'm gonna cut the hose with the big butcher knife. So I run back in the house, and I get a big butcher knife, and I tell my mom, I'm gonna cut the hose. So I go to step off the porch, and she says, stop, look. And there is a cow moose there, and the ears are flat back. Another moose, not the one with the hose wrapped around its neck, but another moose. The ears are flat back, the heckles are raised, and it's getting ready to charge me. So I can't cut the hose because now there's another one getting ready to charge me. Every time I try to step off the porch to cut this hose to save it, there's another one getting ready to charge me. So we're standing here on the porch watching this cow moose buck and trying to, it's killing itself. It's choking on this thing. Well, while it's doing that, it manages to get more hose off the tongue of the trailer, and it goes around and it goes and gets, it starts headbutting her other car, which is parked over on the other side of her driveway. Now, mind you, my car is as well, which is a piece of junk, but it doesn't touch that. Instead, it's headbutting hers, which is just a couple years old, and it's headbutting the back quarter panel and her back door. And there's nothing we can do, because again, that other moose is still watching us, and we can't do anything. So we're just standing there watching this moose, and it comes back to the center of the driveway, and we're watching it. Pretty soon, it keeps pulling and bucking, and it dies. I know, it lays down and it dies. I look at my mom and I'm like, what now? And we watch for a couple of minutes, it's not breathing. And she said, well, I've already called the troopers, so you wait for the troopers, I'm going to bed. Okay. So The adrenaline's gone. I'm tired. I'm cranky. I'm pissed that I've got to wait in the middle of the night for this trooper. So here I am waiting. It's like 20 minutes goes by. Obviously, this is not a priority like I think it should be. Pretty soon, here comes the troopers slowly driving up, and this trooper gets out of the car, guns drawn, and he comes up slowly walking towards this moose. And I'm standing there on the porch, light on, and I said, dead. The next morning, I get up early, because I'm an early riser, and I'm getting up, my mom's already gone to work, and I'm surveying the damage, and I can hear what sounds like a calf crying. And she's got wood surrounding her property, and I can hear a calf crying, but I can't see it. So I go inside, and I call Fish and Wildlife, and I tell them, they know about the incident, obviously from last night. And so they come out and they try to find the calf and they can't find it, but they know about the cow. So they try to connect with it. They come out a couple of times. They report back to me that, and to my mom, that, you know, it looks like, you know, the two of them have connected. And thankfully, you know, that other cow probably took that calf under its wing and it's going to be okay. And in addition, that's, you know, thankfully for that, that's what came out of it. In addition, you know, to the $20,000, over $20,000 to my mom's. Now, my Alaska magazine did find out about the story, and in Alaska, in the Kodiak to Barrow, the 911 call made it from, it's not a moose, it's not a people emergency, it's a moose emergency.
That was Charlene Juliason, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Francisco Martinez.
And I'm Kendall Sormo. Our next storyteller is Molly Brenner. Here she is at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
I'm pretty close with my grandparents. I grew up in Denver, Colorado, and they lived right down the block from me. So while I was growing up, my grandmother was a retired teacher, and my grandfather was a retired engineer. So I would often go over there so they could help me with my homework, or do it for me. They also helped when I was 16 to teach me how to drive when my own parents lost their patience. More importantly, they were there for me during the hard times when I was 13 and my parents got divorced, and when I was 18 and my mother, their daughter, passed away. It was during this time that I decided to stay in Colorado for college, mostly so I could be there for them. Looking back on it, I realized they were definitely there for me more than I could have ever been there for them. After college, I moved away. I moved across the country, and I continued to call them every Sunday. Well, needless to say, I was pretty devastated last May when my grandfather passed away. After more than 65 years of marriage, the last thing my grandmother did was give my grandfather a kiss on the forehead and simply say, "Thank you." May we all be so lucky, right? So last summer, I spent a lot of time worried about my grandma. I increased my weekly calls to 2 to 3 times a week, and I could definitely tell that her mental state was diminishing a little bit. Our conversations would repeat. She'd repeat herself over and over again. And I became more worried when, a couple months later, she fell and broke her hip and needed a full hip replacement. My sister and I would talk often during this time, and we both started thinking, this is the beginning of the end. And I was really upset because I'm getting married this September, and I really want my grandma to be there, especially since my mom can't. It's something that's really important to me. So I was really surprised when one day I got a phone call from my sister and she said, "Grandma has a boyfriend." Now, granted, this is a woman who just got back into her assisted living facility from physical therapy. I was surprised. I mean, she had a 24-hour live-in aide at this point. So I was like, "My grandma?" Well, apparently, my sister had found this out because the assisted living facility had called her. You see, my grandma took this man friend to lunch in her cafeteria and excused the live-in aide so she could go upstairs alone with this man. Well, the aide, not quite knowing what to do, went to management, and management promptly busted in on my grandma in her apartment without her shirt on. Get it, Grandma? My sister didn't quite have the same reaction, and actually, as she was talking to my grandmother about this incident, she got so frazzled and frustrated that she literally ran into a cement pole in her garage and ended the conversation by hanging up on my grandma and saying, "Maybe you shouldn't be so easy." Well, I called my grandma to get her side of the story. "Hi, Grandma. I hear you have a boyfriend." "I do." "How old is he?" "Well, dear, I don't know because I don't want to tell him my age." For the record, my grandma is 88 years old and her boyfriend is 78. Get it, Grandma? So it's at this point that I have a health background. All through college, I worked at a women's health clinic, and I have talked to a lot of young, old, everything in between, women about their sexual health. So I'm like, I can do this. I need to talk to my grandma about her sex life. Say, "Grandma, are you exclusive?" She says, "Oh, I don't think so." So then I start telling her things that, you know, I'm using phrases like, "Don't give away the milk for free," and "Wrap it up." To which she responds, "Oh, yes, dear, I know, I know." I'm glad someone's telling Grandma what's up. I mean, she literally probably has only been with my grandfather. She married him when she was 19 years old, and a lot has changed since then. So I'm glad she's in the know. I was relieved with our conversation. Her relationship continued, and on a Saturday, she invited my family to meet her boyfriend. Well, as usual, I call her on Sunday, and she tells me, "I don't think your sister likes my new boyfriend." "Well, why, Grandma?" "Because he's a goy." So for those that don't know, Grandma's new boyfriend is not Jewish, and we are. But I told you that Grandma's mental state is diminishing a little bit these days, and she forgot that the guy that I'm marrying and have been dating for 8 years is also a goy. I am so proud of Grandma. I have waited 8 years for this. When I started dating my boyfriends, I literally thought my cousin would join me. No, she married a guy from Israel. I thought my sister would join me. No, she married a guy she met on J-Date. I was like, get it, Grandma, it's about damn time someone sins with me. So the relationship progressed and I kept getting some frustrating calls from my sister. And eventually I got a call from my sister and she said, "Your grandma has been caught giving her boyfriend in the cafeteria." Now, my grandma may be many things, but an exhibitionist she is not. She shops at Neiman Marcus. So at this point, I knew something was wrong with Grandma, and unfortunately, something is. She was diagnosed with hypersexual dementia, which really is a thing and exists between 2 to 17% of seniors. Who knew? But I have to say, if this is how Grandma lives out the rest of her days, get it, Grandma. Thank you.
That was Molly Brenner, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA.
Our next storyteller can be found frolicking through mountain passes, and when she was a child, she believed that she was a fairy. Here's Eve Van Domelen.
When I started university, I was, I think, a lot more innocent than the average college-age student. I was raised in Bird Creek in a cabin off the grid in the woods, and my parents homeschooled me and my older brother through high school. This wasn't for religious reasons, it was because we lived pretty far away and my parents wanted to give us an unmarred childhood and wanted to shelter us and kind of retain our innocence a little bit. So when I started university in 2009 at UAA, everything seemed brand new and sparkly and a little scary. I remember some of the early thrills being spending hours Googling things on the internet and binge watching How I Met Your Mother, because how else am I going to learn about pop culture, right? Well, growing up, one of my main forms of entertainment was playing the accordion, which I fell in love with when I was 7. And during high school, this provided a lot of really great learning opportunities and ways to meet new people and have new experiences. I played in a little klezmer trio, and we played bar and bat mitzvahs and even Hanukkah parties. Well, when I got to university, I decided I was going to shake things up a little bit. And so I met some new musicians, and together, me on accordion, Liz on fiddle, and John and Kenny on guitar and drums formed a band called In the Belfry, and we played gypsy punk. We played a lot of music festivals around Alaska during the summer, but when we were in Anchorage and really in the off-season, it was hard to find places to play because we were kind of quirky. We played a lot of coffee shops and art galleries, but there was one venue in a strip mall in Midtown that had some pretty odd and funky shows that we really fit in with, and it was really fun to play there. And so when I was about 19, I got a message from the lady who booked the shows, asking if just me and Liz wanted to play a little afternoon set. And I said, sure, why not? That sounds great. She added to this that it was a costume party, so we should come dressed for the occasion. When the day arrived for the event, Liz and I got ready at the room I was renting on Southside. It was a beautiful spring day, and we were looking forward to maybe even playing outside, or at least playing inside with all the windows and doors open. We hadn't put much thought into what we were going to wear, but I happened to have two of my mom's prom dresses lying around, and they were gunny sack dresses, which are what I'm wearing, a floor-length prairie dress, but fancy. So we threw on our prairie dresses and headed to the show. When we pulled up, things seemed a little strange. There were no cars in the parking lot, and all the blinds were drawn, and the door was shut. I didn't have a cell phone at this point in time, and so I thought maybe, you know, I'd missed it being canceled or I'd gotten the time or the place wrong, but we figured we were there, so we'd go in. We went to the door, and our host was indeed there, and she was a pretty cool lady, always wearing fantastical outfits, and so it was no surprise to see her in a wonderful animal costume, dressed to the nines. As we went in, we asked the normal questions, like, how long exactly are we going to play, and can we take a break midway through, and where do you want us to set up? She had us set up kind of in the middle, a little off-center. But when we got in there, things really started feeling odd. It was beautiful outside, but it was dark inside because the blinds were drawn, and there were a few lamps around, kind of giving it an evening soiree feeling. The room was lined with booths and lots of plants, kind of making it feel like a jungle. And as I started to get my accordion out, I wondered when the party was going to start, because it was silent inside and calm, and, you know, I was glad we'd gotten there early. But I stood up to kind of turn around and get my bearings, and I saw out of the corner of my eye that I was wrong. The party was in full swing. There were people in all of the booths, and they were all staring at us. Not only were they staring at us and were there people, but they were all wearing animal masks. And I wondered, did I get the memo wrong? Was I supposed to wear an animal costume? But as I looked a little closer, I realized that these costumes weren't just animal costumes, they were a little more naughty than that. So I'm there in my prairie dress. And as I start to let my eyes drift a little lower, I realize that this is nothing that watching How I Met Your Mother has prepared me for. It's not even something that taking nude community saunas growing up to get clean has prepared me for, because this party is not about getting clean, or at least I don't think so. I think it's something a little more dirty. As I let my eyes go from the masks down to more the tail or below the waist region, I start to get really uncomfortable because they've forgotten half of their costumes, I think. At this point in time, I start to ask myself a lot of questions. Why just me and Liz? Why am I here? Why am I wearing a prairie dress? And how am I gonna get out of here? So I turn to Liz and I say, Liz, oh my gosh, I've forgotten. I have somewhere I need to be in like 10 minutes. How could I have forgotten this? And I looked at the host and I said, I'm so sorry. I've been so looking forward to playing this show. I really want to stay, but we have to go. And as we rush out, Liz, who's younger than me, but much more worldly, and I jump in the car and I look at her and I say, Liz, what the hell was that? And she looks at me and she says, Eve, I think that was a furry party. Thanks.
Our final storyteller for this show, Tammy Griffin, is the general manager at Crown Plaza Anchorage Midtown and a lifelong Alaskan.
I gotta carry the mic around because I have to walk and talk at the same time. It was my birthday in 2006, and I was on the beach in Mexico, and it wasn't just any beach, it was our beach. And I had a fabulous birthday, maybe the best ever. And thinking back on it, if I had died that day, I would have died happy. And I'm grateful that I was able to tell people that because I've thought about it often. But the day after my birthday, I was awoken from a very nice siesta with my husband yelling, Tammy, get my pants! I have money in my pants! Tammy, we're being robbed! And I was like, oh my God. So I sat up in bed, and there was a man with one huge eyebrow going across his forehead and a large gun pointed at me. So I went, wow, you know, that can't be good. So I went looking for the money pants, and I found them on the floor in the bedroom, and there was a nice big wad of money in the money pants. They were pesos, but it was still a big wad, so I handed them over to Unibrow, and he escorted me into the living room, and oh my God, my husband is hog-tied to a chair. And he's blindfolded, and it's terrible. And my neighbors are on my couch, and they are all tied up, and they're blindfolded. And I'm like, wow, you know, this can't be good. The robbers were going around the house, and they're stealing stuff like they do. And they take my hands and tied me up. And while they're tying me up, they're taking off my wedding ring and taking off my jewelry. And so it's like, okay, it's a robbery, it's gonna be over soon, but no. The guy in charge, the boss, goes over to my husband, says, where's the money? My husband's like, I got you the money, we don't have any more money here. He said, well, this isn't enough, we're taking your wife. So That was bad. And my husband, being very fluent in Spanish, starts talking 90 miles an hour. No, 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 we don't have money. You don't understand. All of our money is in the house. We're not rich. And the guy throws a phone in my husband's lap and he says, "You'll find the money. Call your parents." So in Spanish, my husband quickly says, "No, no, we are the parents. Mi madre's muerto, mi padre's muerto. We have kids." And I thought at that moment that I think we had $1,300 in my checking account. And he wants $3 million. So I'm thinking I'm probably gonna die. So on the way out the door, I asked if I could put on my flip-flops. They did allow that, thank goodness. And they took me off into the jungle. And they started settling in and started taking turns. There were seven of them. Two seemed like the bosses, the unibrow guy and the other boss that, by the way, hit my husband upside the head with a gun. Though they were kind of rough and tough and looked mean, and the others were kind of rookies and did not seem to be all that scary to me. And luckily, I was left with the rookies, and the big bosses took off. And I was able to talk one of my captors very nicely into letting me smoke a cigarette. And when they did that, they untied me. So I sat quietly, wasn't hysterical, didn't cry, and I waited for my opportunity because I really didn't think I was going to get out of there alive unless I could escape. So I waited. And fortunately, the rookies, one of them fell asleep on the job, and the other one stepped away, and I thought, okay, this is my chance. I'm alone, I'm free, and I have a roll of toilet paper, so I can like take that into the woods, and if I get caught, hey, you know, I was just trying to find some privacy. So I snuck off one little step at a time until I felt like I was far enough away, and then I started running. I was literally running through a jungle. Now, you have to understand that I am directionally challenged. I get lost when I walk out of my office and go to the bathroom in an office I've been at for 17 years. So I get out there in the jungle. I don't know what to do. I find a creek. I follow the creek. And then I couldn't go any further. And I thought, okay, well, what would Mike say? Well, Mike, my husband, has given me directional guidance from 2,000 miles away when I was lost in Seattle, when I was lost in LA, when I was lost in Phoenix. He says, "Tammy, where's the sun?" And somehow he magically knows where I am because of where the sun is related to me. So I'm thinking, I'm in the jungle, I want to go to the beach. In Mexico, just like Anchorage, just like Seattle, just like LA, the sun comes up over the mountains and it sets on the water. So that's where I wanted to be. So okay, I'm going to let the sun be at my back and I'm going to go towards the water because I couldn't follow the creek anymore. And so that's what I did. I kept the sun at my back, and all of a sudden, after I walked for a while, I'm in a little village. I come out in a soccer field, and then some ladies in a store help me. I was trying to tell them, "Call the policia, policia, and a pistola, and a la playa." And so I didn't know that you can't just call 911 in Mexico. And so she says something to this little girl, and she goes running off. I'm like, oh my God, is this whole town banditos, and they're going to get my kidnappers, and now I'm going to die? But no, the little girl comes back with a calling card. Because you can't call the police without a calling card in a little town in Mexico. So the lady called the police. They all came cowboyed up out of the pickup truck. Says, "Are you Tammy Griffin?" And I said, yes, I'm Tammy Griffin. And he hands me a phone, and this guy says, I'm Roberto Romero. I'm the head of the FBI in Mexico City. I know where your husband is, and I will send him to you. Stay there. Okay, so I'm going to be safe. So my husband comes, gets me. The next 3 days, we talk to the police and the tourist police. They have tourist police in Mexico. And he actually said, okay, after 3 days, I'm tired of listening to you. I will let you lead me through the jungle to the captors. I knew I could do it. So we all cowboyed up, put on tennis shoes because flip-flops are not that great in the jungle. And so my husband went with me and five state police and the tourist police and Fleur, who was the forensic photographer. And we went back into the jungle, and these guys are following me, and I know that they know that I'm lost. But I'm telling you, I knew exactly where I was going. So we get to the creek where I sat, and I had a cigarette, and I literally lifted the rock and showed them my cigarette butt. And they went, whoa, she knows where she's going. So after that, they jacked their shells, and they were, like, ready to go. And we get to this house out in the jungle, and we get in a big gunfight. And literally, they were shooting at each other. And my husband and I, he's like, down, down. He's, like, covering me up. Like, it's a shootout. Oh, my God. So long story short, we caught several of the kidnappers. It was just the rookies, unfortunately. The bad guys, the mean guys, they got away, Munibrow and the boss. But, you know, the young men learned a valuable lesson about kidnapping. Don't mess with the Alaskan girl. I think that was the headline in the paper, something like that. And just know that in Mexico, lightning does, in fact, strike twice. Because after we got the kidnapping business away, we figured, you know what? We're going to still enjoy our house. Because that couldn't possibly happen again. But, oh yeah. My husband was kidnapped in 2011. But that is another story.
Tammy Griffin was the last storyteller for this hour of Arctic Entries Radio.
To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
The Arctic Entries website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you could tell a story. We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show, all of whom are volunteers, by the way. The proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about this is also on our website.
And thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Streams for our theme music. This has been Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSK Anchorage. I'm Francisco Martinez.
And I'm Kendall Stormo. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories. Or play from the rock. I love the start of new things to come. And I love your lips. What I can't be some.